This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Well, strap yourselves in. It's another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello, thanks for giving us a listen. My name's Dan. This is the place where only the most amazing, weird, and deadly things in the universe can be spoken of. You know, it's a bit like He Who Must Not Be Named from Harry Potter, only there's more rockets and Large Hadron Colliders. Now, today, we're chatting about a disorder that turns people into trees. Also, we'll chat about ancient tattoos, and we'll learn how trains get their power. First, it's over to our Geology Rocks series. This is with one of our Fun Kids friends called Finley, and today, he's having a look at how the Earth is made and what its history's been.
Geology Rocks!
I love being outside. Well, I'm not going to find any rocks or fossils indoors, am I? It's nice to get a breath of fresh air. You probably know that we need oxygen to breathe. But where does it come from? The answer is plants. Maybe you didn't know that. But it's not like they're doing us a massive favour. Plants need us as well. It's part of a process called photosynthesis. To put it simply, plants give out oxygen, which we breathe in, and we breathe out carbon dioxide, which plants absorb. But you know, it's like a swap. But it's a very important swap, because without it, neither of us could survive. What you might not know is that there are some very cool rocks called stromatolites. They show us how the swap started. Do you want to take a look? Come on, we need to travel back 3 billion years. Wow, there isn't much life on Earth. Well, not that you can see. But here, in the shallower oceans, a very important group of microscopic creatures are beginning to appear. They're called blue-green cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae. Here's some. Now, if you were to see these yourself, you'd probably think, yuck! The algae all lump together in huge numbers and make a big, sticky mass on the ocean floor. The top layer is a bit like a skin, and that's where photosynthesis happens. The oxygen that they're giving off is floating in the Earth's atmosphere. Huge amounts of oxygen, changing the atmosphere forever. Although, it didn't happen overnight. It would take another billion years or so for enough oxygen to be produced to support more complicated forms of life. But in time, that meant us humans too. So it's worth the wait. So thanks, blue-green algae. So how do we know about this helpful sticky stuff? Well, over the years, the sticky top layer of algae replaced itself, growing a new skin over the top. Because it's surrounded by the sea and sand, bits of sand and silt get trapped in these layers, creating rocky structures. Over millions of years, domes and pillars and sometimes even cones were created. Some even survive today. And if you were to look at them, you'd see layer after layer, a bit like the rings in tree trunks. These rocks are called stromatolites, and they are one of the most important early rocks because of what they tell us about the changing atmosphere all those millions of years ago.
Geology Pit.
Stromatolites aren't just stuck in the past. They're still being made by the blue-green algae today. One famous location is Shark Bay in Western Australia. They'll never grow in the same great numbers again, though. This is because today there is so much more life on Earth. And for some animals, the algae make a tasty meal. It's often eaten before it even has a chance to form layers. This means they only tend to appear where the sea conditions are too salty or too remote to attract hungry wildlife. It's kind of funny when you think about it. Without the blue-green algae, all those hungry life forms would never have existed in the first place. Time to go! See you again soon! In the meantime, find out more on the Fun Kids website.
You can get all our Geology Rocks episodes for free right now. Open up your phone or tablet and get to the free Fun Kids app. You can also listen wherever you get your podcast from normally, you know, places like iTunes, and you can listen at funkidslive.com. You know what? I feel like saying a little hello on the show right now. And to do that, you know this, right? We need to spin the Fun Kids shout-out wheel. It's the one in the studio that's covered in names. And those are the names of people who have left the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review on the iTunes podcast store. So it makes sense that if you want to have a chance of getting a shout-out, you need to do that. And by the way, 5 stars always helps. I've given it a spin, it's gone past Lucy and Max and Oscar, and it's landing on... There we go! Stopped! Zoe, hello to you. Zoe says that she loves the show because she learns loads of new stuff about science and the universe, and also it's a mix of all her favourite Fun Kid series, which is amazing, Zoe. You've really got it. That's the thing we're after. A little bit of old and a little bit of new and a lot of fun along the way. Thank you so much for the review, by the way. You see, listen to that. It's so simple. If you want your name to be on the Fun Kids wheel of shoutouts to even stand a chance of getting a hello on this show next week, you need to leave us a review. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on the iTunes podcast store and drop us 5 stars. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now this year, 2018, is the year of engineering, and I thought we'd celebrate. So I've sent Fun Kids' favourite inventor, Sir Sidney McSprocket, all over the country to chat to real-life engineers to see which famous inventors have inspired them.
Hello there. Nice to see you. I've just finished the designs for a brand new car which is powered by the smell from sweaty socks. Hey, it's really fast, but the exhaust fumes smell disgusting. Really won't do. Imagine getting stuck in the traffic jam. Anyway, speaking of jams, I've been out on the road meeting some brilliant young engineers. Recently, I was at Airbus. It's a massive place down in Bristol where they design and make aeroplanes. While I was there, I met some inspired engineers. So, this is Matt from Airbus. Now, can you explain what it is you do here, laddie?
I am an engineer in landing gear, so I deal with all the wheels and all the bit that touches the ground of the airplane at Airbus. Yeah, I get up to all the designing and putting parts actually on the plane and testing them out. So, yeah, it's a pretty cool job.
Oh, that's a very interesting sounding job. Were there any people who inspired you to become an engineer?
Well, I'm local to Bristol, and the man in Bristol is... IEKB, Isambard Kingdom Brunel. He's designed all sorts of things like suspension bridge. You've seen all the big pictures of those. He designed big ships, SS Great Britain, Great Eastern, and yeah, he's a great bloke.
Right then, this Brunel chap sounds like my kind of lad. We should find out a bit more about his engineering. This calls for my latest invention, the Universal Inspiromatic. Inspiro for short. Ask it anything you like, and in the blink of an eye, it will give you all the inspiring information you need. Let's fire this baby up.
Isambard, Kingdom, Brunel.
Ah, it's loading a report. Now then, what have you got for me?
Brunel was a civil engineer who specialized in transport. He worked on tunnels, railways, bridges, and ships, and his work is considered so important, he was recently voted the second greatest Briton of all time, second only to Winston Churchill, no less. Amongst his greatest achievements were the Clifton Suspension Bridge, the Great Western Railway, and the giant ship, the SS Great Britain. He was born in 1806 to a French father.
French? I thought he was the second greatest Briton of all time.
Well, I guess that does make him half French, but you won't believe what his inspired engineering did for Great Britain in his lifetime. Let me show you. Here we are at Bristol's Clifton Suspension Bridge. Don't look down. We are pretty high up. It is over 75 meters down to the River Avon.
Pretty impressive. But what inspired Brunel to design it?
It was actually a competition which got Brunel designing the suspension bridge. It was decided that a bridge was needed and engineers were asked to submit designs. Brunel put in 4 designs and was awarded 2nd place. But he was so passionate about his ideas that in the end he managed to persuade the committee to give him 1st prize and his design was chosen.
Well, he certainly sounds determined. Tell me more about his design.
A suspension bridge is one which uses cables to distribute the weight of the bridge to the high towers which hold them. This, in turn, transfers the weight to the ground. The chains are huge, and here are made up of 4,200 links. It was originally designed to just let people and horse-drawn carts cross, but Brunel's design was so good, it now carries 4 million cars a year.
Oh, talking of cars, laddie, I think Brunel has inspired me to solve the stinky problems of my sweaty, soft car. Let's get back on the road. I recently went to the Institute of Engineering and Technology in Birmingham, where I met an assembly of brilliant young engineers, like this one.
Hi, my name is Roma, and I'm a structural engineer. What that means is that I'm responsible for making sure that the buildings and bridges that we live in or use are strong enough and safe enough for us to walk on.
I see. And is there anyone who inspired you to become an engineer?
So the engineer that inspired me most is called Emily Roebling, and she was the wife of the person that was building the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. And when he got very sick, she spent 11 years leading the project and making sure that it got built. And I think that that's brilliant.
Well, indeed, today engineers can be women or men. But back when the Brooklyn Bridge was being built, things were very different. Spyro, can you give us the lowdown on Emily Roebling?
Initializing search. Emily Roebling. Loading report. Emily Roebling was the wife of engineer Washington Roebling. Washington inherited the job of constructing the iconic Brooklyn Bridge in New York in the mid-1800s. Shortly into the project, Washington became ill, and this was the moment Emily stepped up to change history.
Change history? Surely that makes her an American heroine.
Indeed, she was. And let me tell you, back then many people thought that women weren't as clever as men and simply couldn't understand the complex ideas needed for large-scale engineering projects like this one. Unwilling to let her husband's efforts amount to nothing, Emily set out to prove the doubters wrong, and she took on the role of chief engineer. With a lot of hard work and some teaching from her husband, she mastered complicated subjects such as stress analysis, material strength, cable construction, and the calculation of catenary curves.
Catenary curves? I once read a book about those, and it was so complicated, it made me go cross-eyed.
Well, that's as may be. But Emily Roebling had no time for such silliness. She had to be absolutely sure she understood everything she was doing. The Brooklyn Bridge was state-of-the-art for its day. For example, being the first bridge in the world built with steel suspension cables. There were so many people who couldn't believe a woman could do such a complicated job, they simply wanted to see her fail. Despite this, Emily continued to lead the bridge-building project for 14 years and completed it without mishap. Such was her triumph. She was invited to be the first to cross it in a carriage when it opened in 1882. The bridge survives to this day and is still one of New York's busiest. It bears a plaque dedicated to Emily Roebling and her extraordinary achievement.
What an inspiration. I'm going to phone my niece in Dumfries to tell her all about it. I'll see you next time. Doodaloo.
It's time to talk about some of the most deadly, mean and strange things in the universe in this week's Dangerous Dan. And today, it's an illness that turns humans into forests. Epidermodes plasia verruci formis is an extremely rare disorder. It's passed through your genes down your family, and it's also known as tree man syndrome. Honestly, it does exactly what it says on the tin. It turns people, regular humans like you and me, into something that look like trees. And it's not really nice to be glamorous about this. It's really gruesome, and it does affect real people. I mean, not a lot. There have only been 5 notable cases, but still, I'm gonna try and tread carefully here. It causes you to grow hundreds of scaly warts, macules and papules all over your skin, which then start to look like wood. And they look like bark with the brown flakiness of a tree. And these abnormal, strange lesions, they focus around the face, the neck and the body, and they do tend to stick to one of your limbs, right? But it turns that limb, in like your arm, your leg, something like that, it turns it into a thing that looks like a fallen branch covered in warts. The worst part is that there's no known cure for Tree Man Syndrome. The only way to get rid of it is to get rid of it, to amputate the part and cut it off at its source. It's time for a brand new series now on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's Britain's Digital Railways, where Bex from the club in the afternoons on Fun Kids and I were travelling all over the UK learning about the rails and the trains that get us from A to B. And today, we're finding out how they're powered.
Britain's Digital Railway.
Digger. Wires. Pylons, cranes, wow, Bex! There's loads of machinery and equipment over there.
Yeah, it's all needed to electrify this part of the railway. You see that? It's one of the new electrification factory trains.
Isn't electrifying a bad thing? My mum tells me I'll electrify myself if I stick a fork in the toaster.
Okay, yeah, being electrified is definitely a bad thing. But here we're just talking about converting the power source that trains can use to electricity. And that's a great thing.
Bex is right. Railway electrification is a great thing. It enables faster, greener and more reliable trains. And as well as being better for passengers, electric trains are lighter and cause less wear and tear to the track.
Still seems like a lot of disruption. Just to change the power source.
Well, they can't just plug them in. All sorts of things have to change.
When the Victorians built the railways, they built them for steam trains. And many things they built weren't designed with electric trains using overhead lines in mind. Things like tunnels and bridges might not have enough room to fit both the trains and the new overhead wires that need to be installed. To create room, engineers might need to excavate and lower the track bed. Bridges might need to be jacked up or even rebuilt if they're too low. Changes might also need to be made around stations to make sure there's enough of a gap between buildings and the overhead wires to keep everyone at a safe distance and prevent people accidentally electrocuting themselves. It can cost a lot of money to make these changes, but safety is the top priority. Platforms themselves might need to be lengthened to accommodate the longer, high-capacity electric trains. Once engineers have created enough space to accommodate the overhead wires, they then can start to build the infrastructure that will supply the trains with the electricity. This includes electricity substations that provide the 25,000 volts of power to the wires, and masts and pylons that hold the wires high above the trains. Overhead line masts need strong foundations to ensure they don't sway when trains pass. These foundations are created by either piling, that's when hollow steel tubes are first vibrated into the ground and then struck repeatedly with a large hydraulic hammer until they're deep enough, or by pouring concrete into excavated holes to create a solid base onto which the masts are attached. Masts are placed approximately every 50 metres to keep the electrified wires running between them under the correct tension for trains to pass safely. Attached to the masts are cantilevers, structures that hold the electrified wires above the tracks. These may reach across one, two or more lines. To help electrify new lines, Network Rail has a state-of-the-art high-output factory train that helps engineers electrify more tracks more quickly. This train has 23 vehicles, 5 dig the foundations and fill them with concrete, while another 5 drive the steel tube piles into the ground. 3 vehicles install the main steelwork for the OLE structures, whilst a further 5 install small part steelwork to the masts, and 3 hang up the wires. The train carries everything it needs to install the overhead wiring and the structures that hold the electrical equipment. So as well as piling tubes and steel gantry sections, it carries drums of electrical wire.
Well, if it makes the journey go more quickly, I'm all for it.
I agree. It's electrifying. See what I did there?
Way too obvious, mate.
Britain's Digital Railway. With support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/railway.
Now we're talking about how you can save someone's life in just a sec. First, a very quick reminder that if you've got a question about science that's niggling around in your brain, you just can't massage out the answer, right? I can help you out with it, don't worry. if it's silly or if it's serious. It doesn't matter. If it's about science, then I want to know. I can get it answered for you. It could be about the rings of Saturn or the tasty deliciousness of a ringed donut. If it's about science, it doesn't matter. I'll try and get it answered by a proper genius expert. Send me your science question right now, whatever it is, doesn't matter. Get online, let me know, funkidslive.com. Click on my page. It's time to have a look at all the science that's been in the news this week. Now, the Entomological Society of America is updating its list of insect names to show that termites are really cockroaches. Who knew? Termites, they're the bugs, you know, that chew through wood. They're always in cartoons and stuff. But after extensive research and genetic evidence, scientists have found that these really belong to the cockroach family. Also, researchers have found the oldest tattoos in the world on two 5,000-year-old ancient mummies from Egypt. The drawings are of a bull and a sheep, and scientists say that this discovery has transformed understanding of how people lived in that era. And finally, pesticides are putting bees at risk. Now, these, with insecticides, are used on crops to kill off certain diseases and to make them tastier, but they're also being eaten by bees and honeybees. The European Safety Authority has now deemed them completely unsafe for the buzzy bees, and their use is now being reviewed. Let's catch up then with our microbe germ friends, Benny and Mal, on the show. This is from our Demanding Dilemmas series, and they're looking at the things that we can do with science, but asking whether we really should. And today we're finding out how you can save someone else's life.
Benny and Mal's Body Teasers, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics.
Ah, hello again. Sorry about the ruckus. My friends Benny and Mal, you know, microbes that live at the bottom of an old test tube, are single-celled organisms that are very single-minded. Just have a listen. Benny and Mal never agree on anything.
No, I am listening. You're the one that's not listening.
So, lads, what's the hot topic today? Oi, lads, what's the hot topic?
Sorry, mate. Mal doesn't like sharing the limelight. And our hot topic is about sharing too. Or rather, donating our organs. You know, letting other people use your squidgy bits and bobs after you've died. Could be your heart, lungs, even your skin and eyeballs.
Ugh, I do not like the idea of someone else deciding what happens to my body, even if I am dead. Just keep your hands off the goods. Do not touch the merchandise.
You're not the only one who thinks having control over what happens to your own body is important. If you're not in charge, then who is? And who decides? You could end up
being controlled by somebody else in any way he or she wanted to, like a puppet on a string.
Well, that's quite a logical leap there. You're right that if we don't have a say, then maybe it will be the most powerful or rich people who decide what happens to our bodies.
Exactly. So I'm in charge. I say exactly what happens to this body.
But are you, like, tote sure about that? Think of it this way. If you had an accident and needed donated organs or blood, you might be too poorly to give the doctor permission. Does this mean it would be wrong to go ahead?
Yes.
Even if it saved your life?
Well, no. That would be okay. I wouldn't mind receiving organs.
Aha. So having 100% control over what happens isn't so important to you now, is it?
I still just don't like the idea of organ donation. It's icky.
Well, you might think it is icky, but it's also a kind and generous thing to do to save someone else's life. Isn't that important?
I'm a very generous person, and I do lots of kind things.
As if.
I do! And if someone tells me to do something kind, it's not really kind, is it? It's like being told to say sorry when you're not.
Interesting point there. Certainly something to think about. But here's something else to think about. There are thousands of people right now whose lives could be saved by organ transplants, but there just aren't enough donors.
Well, why don't the government give people a nice little reward for being an organ donor? Nice crisp £10 note might change my mind.
Woo! Thank you very much!
Rewards could be a way to get more donors, but it's tricky because it's against the law to sell bits of your body.
Well, rewards don't have to be money. Maybe if you donate, then you get to be first in the queue if you need an organ.
It's certainly an idea, but not that simple. Organs have to match, or the transplant just won't work. Doctors give donated organs to the people who stand the best chance of getting better.
Well, that does sound fair.
It is, mate, it is. Fairness is very important. It's also sensible, because it means
means as few as possible of these precious organs are wasted.
Well, if you can't give people money and they can't jump the queue, what benefits can you give them?
How about the knowledge that they're saving someone's life? A warm, fuzzy feeling of just being a nice person.
I'd rather have the tenner, but that's just my opinion.
It's a brain-busting body bamboozler for sure.
Sure is. Catch you next time.
Benny and Mal's Body Teasers, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Benny and Mal.
And that is it for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly then. If you've enjoyed it, remember, give us a review on the iTunes podcast store. You might get a shout out on the show next week. And also, if you've got any kind of sciencey question that's niggling away at your brain, let me help you out with that. Send it over to my page right now at funkidslive.com. And we'll be back with another brain-busting and jaw-dropping episode next week. If you can't wait till then, though, you can catch up on all our brilliant Fun Kids Science series for free. Right now, go to the free Fun Kids app on your phone or tablet. You can also listen wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes and at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.